I just.
Bill, this is probably a stupid question.
Well, then it's obviously in my area of expertise.
Do you know whose episode this is?
I don't know, but I'll take it because I have strong feelings about this episode.
Do you?
Yes.
Oh, good.
In fact, as do Andrew and I.
In fact, I'm not even going to read a synopsis because I've already got one. I can do one off the cuff.
Excellent. Best kind of synopsis.
Wow.
Yeah.
I get the feeling your strong feelings are similar to our strong feelings.
Yes, I'm sure they are. Because if they're not, we're going to be fighting.
You would fight me, Aka'ar?
Bring it.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
You Starfleet officers! Now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garak. Plain, simple, Garak.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to The Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast. And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro.
Bloody hell.
So I'm the opener?
If you're going to do the synopsis thing.
Where's the... is this... Oh, I'm on the actors. I was on Brett Cullen's page, the guy that plays...
Person of interest.
Well, he was... what was his name on this episode?
Quark.
No, Dural. He was the guy that Jadzia just magically fought. Hello, and welcome to another exciting... fun-filled, action-packed. Maybe not. We'll have to see. Oh, I'm burying the lead again. Of Listen to the Prophets.
Well, it's going to be a fun-filled, exciting show of Listen to the Prophets.
Oh, that's true, yes. Just maybe what we're reviewing might be questionable.
But you'll have to stay tuned to see.
That's true. And that was my co-host, Paul Spataro, and the other giggling fiend in the background.
Cackling is probably a better word.
Giggling and cackling fiend would be...
I'm going to get you, my pretty. You and your little dog, too.
Oh, that's just scary, because then I see you in a black dress and a black hat. That's just...
Hey, you didn't complain on Friday, dude.
Shh. Look, man, what stays in it, what happens in England stays in England.
What happens in Orlando stays in Orlando.
We're going for OzCon. I'm going to be the cowardly lion.
Friends of Dorothy.
I'm going to be the cowardly lion. You can be the wicked witch.
I want to be the scarecrow.
How about you, Paul? What are you going to be?
Well, if you're taking the lion, you're kind of taking my role from me a little there. But I guess I could be like a jackass and I could be the wizard.
You're the one who puts it all together and we don't peek behind the curtain. There you go.
Let's see the wizard. No way, no how.
I am the great and powerful Paul.
That probably fits my producer persona.
Yeah, really? Just your producer? Really? I distinctly remember staying at your house. All right, get up. Get up down there. Let's go. Breakfast's getting cold.
The fact that I came down and threw a bucket of water on you should not be a problem.
It was cold. Shrinkage, Jerry. Shrinkage.
You're a grower, not a shower.
Oh, well, and as you can see by our
that was preamble.
Stalling, you are stalling!
I love that. Do you know that's become my de facto thing in my head when somebody irritates me? You are failing! And it's all your fault.
That's Bill and Scott. I've fallen in line with it, but that was them that brought that to the forefront.
It's genius, whatever it is.
that's from Captain America with the Red Skull. It's Hugo Weaving when he yells at his underlings or whatever. You are family. I often say that at work, although. Oh, okay. We'll stop stalling and get on with the episode.
Yeah.
Oh, we have, you know, there is some sort of Star Trek news out there.
Do we have any Star Trek news today? Oh, by the way, we're going to review, eventually, we're going to review the Deep Space Nine episode Meridian. There, I said it. Okay.
Star Trek Beyond's about to be released. It's the big news, obviously. Mm.
By the time you hear this, though, it would have already been in the theater and hopefully gone. I mean, just gone. I mean, done rather well.
Mm. Well, as we record this, we're 2 weeks from the release. By the next time we record, I may or may not have seen it.
Yeah. I am open-minded. If you say it's really good, I'll probably go and see it.
I will be surprised if I tell you that.
Me too.
If you tell me it is a great movie and I should go see it, Paul, I will probably see it, but I will not go see it. Well, unless I get a roaring recommendation from somebody, whose opinion I trust,
and that's the battle that it's fighting, isn't it? We were all on board for 09, and even with its problems, I didn't mind that one. I don't think it holds up terribly well to repeated viewing, but on first view, you're like, oh, okay, all right, well, let's see where they go with it, and then Into Darkness just squandered any goodwill we may have had. Mm-hmm. So the point where now we're looking down the barrel of the third one and going, you're really going to have to win me back, guys.
Yeah.
Well, I do expect to see it. The kids said they want to see it with me. So once I have, I don't know if I will have seen it by the next time we record, but if I have, I'll give you my honest take on it. Mm-hmm. And I will, you know, try and give you the unemotional description of what to expect, and then you could decide if you're going to see it. My guess is, if it's what I hope it is, then maybe it'll be good enough for you to see it when it gets to the cheaper theater. But I don't think I don't really hold out much hope that it's going to be something that you're going to want to rush to the theater to see. Hmm. But we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the news on that one is they announced now that that Sulu is gay on the show, mm-hmm. in the movie.
Yeah, and I guess George Takei doesn't agree with that.
Yeah, George Takei basically gave a statement that says something to the effect of, I'm very happy that there's a gay ongoing character in Star Trek. I just don't think it should be Sulu, because that isn't what Gene Roddenberry envisioned. And now Simon Pegg came back and has said, that's true, but that's really a byproduct of the fact that, you know, of the times, that Gene Roddenberry couldn't have a gay character back then. Not because he really cared about his sexuality to that extent. So, I don't know. I do feel that I sometimes have a problem with them taking an established character and just kind of changing things. On the other hand, I don't know if we really had much of an indication of Sulu's sexual, you know, desires anyway. So I'm kind of ambivalent on the whole thing.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same as you. Mirror Mirror is the only real one that I can remember even broaching that subject, and he was all over Uhura, but it was in a very sadistic way.
Yeah,
you didn't get the impression that he actually fancied her or anything. And then we found out he has a daughter. But there's absolutely no reason that couldn't be an adopted daughter.
Well,
so,
I think that's what they said on in the movie. I don't know if it's in. I assume it's in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
That he's going to have a same-sex partner and they're going to have a baby daughter.
Right, fair enough.
I just, more or less, I'd rather they don't delve too much into their personal lives off the ship like that. You know, I don't know if that's what I want to see.
Well, I kind of think Star Trek's more inclined to go down that route anyway, because that's what Star Trek is.
But I think more of their personal aspects are their interaction with each other, you know, that they're kind of a big family and they interact together. You don't see too much of, you know, what their lives are off the ship. I mean, you do get the occasional, you know, Picard with his brother or whatever. Mm. Or Kirk goes to visit his brother's dead and he no longer cares that he had a brother. things like that. But there's very, very little of their, you know, private lives off the ship. No, so I don't know that I really want to go too far afield with it. But if they, you know, it's hard to judge it having not seen it yet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really that bothered because I wasn't that interested in seeing it. If it's just there, it don't bother me. Sulu's sexuality is not affecting the show for me because the show wasn't about Sulu.
Yeah, I do kind of feel that way. It really doesn't matter to me. And if, you know, if the, what is it, LGBT community? Am I saying that right? I don't know.
Yeah,
the acronym right?
Yeah, lesbian, gay, bi, trans, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if that community feels, hey, this is good for us that there's a significant character and he's being shown in a positive light, you know, that's good. I have no real problem with
that. Well, some people have said as well that Deep Space Nine got there first with the Trill.
Oh, well, or was that actually on Next Gen? Because there was the character, there was a male character, there was a Trill that was in love with Crusher, and then they had to transfer the symbiote, and then it was transferred into a woman, and the woman still had feelings for Crusher, but Crusher was like, whoa, I don't know about this.
Well, that was the introduction of the Trill to the Star Trek universe. And back then it was different, because then the symbiote had total control over the host.
Yeah,
the host's personality was totally submerged.
Well, that would have been a more like a trans character, I guess you could say.
Yeah, well, that's what they've said. Star Trek has already been down there with a trans character, if that's what you want to read the Trill as. And,
you also
know,
had the TNG episode where there was the race of people who were basically androgynous.
Yeah.
And then there was the one who actually felt that she was a woman.
Oh, yeah, and they
had,
like,
she had the affair with Riker.
Yeah, and they decided they were going to mind wipe her or whatever, or give her, quote-unquote, training to fix her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a more on-the-nose way of it, but, yeah, that's definitely the... Isn't there that character, there's a he-she character in Peter David's New Frontier novels as well, isn't there?
Oh, I have them, so. But it's been so long since I read them, I do not remember.
I think I've heard mention of that, but I don't know that they're considering that because that's off-screen. I think they're really trying to say, you know, an on-screen character, so... Yeah.
So, LGBT could be lesbian, gay, bisexual, Trill.
Yeah, well, that works perfectly well. I think the other big news regarding Star Trek Beyond is the death of Anton Yelchin.
Ooh, yeah. That's something, huh?
Yeah, that was quite... Because originally you see that on social media and you go, yeah, this is another one of those stupid jokes. And then when you start being it reported on legitimate news sites, you go, oh...
And
this isn't a stupid joke.
Supposedly was some freak accident with his...
With his car, yeah.
Yeah.
I assume he had a standard transmission vehicle, because apparently he left it in neutral, which you wouldn't put an automatic transmission in neutral in your driveway. You would put a standard transmission in neutral, and then you'd apply the safety brake.
Yeah.
So either he didn't apply the brake or he applied it and it came loose or something. And then he was pinned against, I think he had a brick structure that made his mailbox or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it rolled down and it pinned him.
Yeah.
And I didn't get from the description if he got crushed and killed or if he was held there and slowly died. But either way, it's terrible.
So is this going to be his last movie, or he made a couple more?
I don't know. I mean, generally they hire or they sign these actors to a 3-movie commitment. That seems to be the standard nowadays.
No, so. And he made another one after Star Trek.
Oh, you mean just him in general?
Yeah. Like, is there something in the can that he's done?
Yeah.
Because
this was filmed a year ago because of the special effects, isn't it? So he may have done... There may be other things coming out. He may still be on screen for about a year or so. Like Seymour Hoffman. Had a couple of things coming out long after he was dead because of the post-production time. Like, was it Hunger Games? Came out a good year or two after he died because of the production time.
You know, we just watched that, the Mockingjay Part 2. What a piece of crap.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes, there's more coming out. I just looked. There's a movie for 2016... We Don't Belong Here. It says complete. It doesn't have it. It just says for the year, so I don't know if it's been released yet.
Right.
Like, Thoroughbred is in post-production for 2017, and a movie called Porto. So that's, yeah, he's got a few other things coming out.
Well, that was a shame.
Yeah, that's terrible. I'm going to just assume, you know, you hear these things and your mind starts racing into, you know, what was he, drunk or whatever. And from the way they describe it, there's no indication of anything like that. So I'd rather just think it's, you know, a tragic accident and that's all.
It does seem like there's nothing nefarious or odd about it. He was getting the car out, he's gone to the post box, and something's happened.
Yeah, it's a shame. And, you know, just I touched on the three movie commitment. So I don't know what their plans are as far as beyond Star Trek Beyond.
Apparently Pine and Quinto have signed up for a fourth one.
Then my guess is they will do a fourth one. You know, probably what the budget's going to be will be dependent on how much this one makes. But I would imagine they'll do one under any circumstances, unless this is like an incredible failure. And I do think among the younger generation, there is something, you know, that there is some popularity for these movies. I think it's more the older crowd that, you know, has strong memories of the original series that's more coming, you know, more hesitant to come into this.
That's okay. We're all dying off. Oh, I'm sorry. I say that out loud.
Well, there was that comment from Christopher Pine, and all I heard was the sound bite, so it may be totally out of context. But he made some sort of comment that, you know, you can't make a deep story or something along those lines for today's generation.
Yeah, you can't. I saw that. You can't make a cerebral Star Trek story in 2016. Was the quote.
My hopes is that he was just taken out of context. You know, I'm not gonna think he didn't say it, but maybe he said it in a different way.
See, I didn't, again, like you, I've not read the full thing, but I'm kind of thinking he was probably like, it was more along the lines of, you've seen, you've got to kind of layer this stuff now with loads of action to appeal to a wider audience. That's kind of where I think he was going with. You can't just make a cerebral Star Trek the motion picture movie in 2016, in which case I wouldn't disagree with what he said.
Yeah, well, I mean, even in 1977, you couldn't make a cerebral Star Trek without people criticizing it.
So, like, even something that does have a lot of ideas in it, like Elysium or Oblivion, there's still a lot of action in those movies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily disagree with the sentiment. It's just...
Yeah, that's... like I said, I don't know that's what he said, but if that's, you know, the general gist of it, I don't think I disagree with it.
Or maybe, maybe that wasn't really meant as a dig on the fandom.
Yeah, it was more a dig on the state of blockbuster filmmaking.
Right, yeah. That's more a dig on the studio system, in that they're less likely to spend $250 million on a cerebral film.
Well, I think the studio system should maybe... I've said this so many times, and I know, Andy, you've talked about that it doesn't really work that way because of advertising or whatever. But I would love to see the studio system say, you know, that's correct. We can't spend $250 million for a cerebral movie, because if it doesn't hit big, we're not going to make that $250 million back. But I still see no reason why they couldn't make an $80 or $90 million cerebral movie, because you don't need the same special effects usually for a cerebral movie. You don't need the blockbuster CGI stuff. So why they couldn't say, let's make a smaller scale movie, and you know, our expectations can be somewhat more modest, and we'd still be turning a nice profit. I never understood the logic behind that, and I know there is financial logic to it. I just never understood it.
No, I think it related more to the advertising, but you've got so many outlets now. I mean, what's wrong with doing a Netflix movie and just seeing where that lands, seeing how well it does? You know, if you keep the budget to something reasonable and do it as a Netflix thing and just see how well it performs, and if it performs well, good, and if it doesn't, you probably won't lose money.
Well, and that's my hopes for the new series, I guess. That they can go, you know, a little bit back more to the roots.
The one that we're going to have to supposedly pay to see.
Yeah, the one that I'm not going to pay to see.
I'm wondering how that's going to work out for them. But we'll see. I mean, if they'd gone Netflix, I think that would have been better for them. But again.
Well, have you guys been keeping up on the whole... I guess they came to an agreement with fandom, with fan films.
Yeah, have you read that agreement?
No, I haven't, and I'm a little concerned because I thought it was good, but then one of the things that I listened to is an audio drama called Star Trek Outpost that one of the members of Two True Freaks years ago on the Facebook page, I believe it was Robert Bell, said, you know, he's like, you should listen to this. And I loved that production. They had over 72, 73 episodes, and they've had to stop production because of this recent change or whatever. And I know there was the other, did you ever see the, they were trying to work on a fan film called Anaxar?
Well, that's the one that's kicked all this off, isn't it?
Right. And so what did you read more on? You've obviously read more of the actual ruling than I did. So what did it say, Andy?
The ruling was basically you're not allowed to make anything over 15 minutes.
What?
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of other addendums and what's it's in there as well. But the bottom line is you're not allowed to make anything over 15 minutes. I think it was 15 or 20. It wasn't very long. It wasn't episode length. And that thing that you sent me that had Gigi Edgley and it was the length of a standard episode, wasn't it? 47 minutes. And it was
really good.
Right,
so you're saying that those can't... Oh, man.
Yep. So basically, they've stopped them from doing them without actually saying that they're stopping them from doing them.
Huh. Well, just film the whole thing and release it in three parts.
Release it in 10-minute chunks, yeah.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yep. Do it in five acts, like a TV episode is nowadays, and just release it that way. There are clever fans out there, Bill. They'll find a way around it. They've been doing that to the studio since you know fandom began, and they'll keep doing it.
Well, because Star Trek Outpost, they would usually have 35 to sometimes 60 minute episodes, and I started to listen to that back when I was recovering from my kidney stone operation. So I was really using that as a distraction, you know, like to take my mind off of things, and I really grew to love it because it takes place on Deep Space 3 and it's on the edge of the Federation and the First Federation, you know, from Baylock and from that episode. It takes place right on the edge of that space, and it's great. If you should go on iTunes, hopefully it's all still there. And it's Star Trek Outpost by Giant Gnome Productions. I would definitely give it a listen. And there's still about 72. There should be about 70 some odd episodes and small episodes and special episodes. So I'm going to say there's probably about 80 on there.
Because it does beg the question as well, is this new really going to be retroactive?
Oh yeah, so
they're
gonna have
to
pull down the old ones.
Are they gonna have to take all that down? Yeah.
Oh, hold on. Let me look. I can look right here real quick. Star Trek, I suppose. Look at the feed. No, the feed still has them all there.
Right.
So.
Download them quick.
Yeah, download them fast. Get them while they're hot. Depressing, sad news.
Yeah. Right. So that's our Star Trek news for today. Which, by the time you hear this, will be old news.
Oh, yeah. Yes, because maybe by the time you hear this, those podcasts won't be up there anymore.
Yeah, true.
But in the meanwhile, how about that Meridian, huh?
Meridian.
Yeah. All right, should we get this out the way?
Can we just call it Adjunct instead of Meridian?
A world on the edge of existence.
It shifts between this dimension and another.
A passion Dax cannot deny.
We'll see each other again.
In 60 years. I want you with me now.
But how will their love last forever?
What if I stayed here with you?
But how do you know that's possible?
When his planet's about to vanish for a lifetime.
The planet and all its inhabitants will cease to exist.
Next time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Go on, Bill. Tell us who wrote, directed it, and...
Well, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, episode Meridian, is season 3, episode 8. It was directed by Jonathan Frakes, which just goes to point out that they all can't be knocked out of the park. And is written by Gene Roddenberry, Rick Berman, well, created by Gene Roddenberry. As we said earlier, he was not around at this time. Written by Rick Berman and Michael Piller. I don't really have a lot of other credits, but at this point, it doesn't really matter. Who's the main?
I've got the stories by Hilary Barder and Evan Carlos Summers.
Ah, okay. So, I'm not going to read a synopsis from anywhere because I'm just going to tell you what the synopsis is. This is a tale of two teledramas. I honestly think that one part of this, I'm going to call this the good part and the bad part. There is no ugly part, but you got the good and the bad. The good part is the part that takes place in Quark's bar, where Quark is servicing a customer. No, not like that.
Well, pretty much like that.
Well, pretty much like that. Eventually, he's trying to. And he might literally be doing that by what happens at the end of his storyline. So we'll take the good storyline first. Quark is servicing a customer who is played by Jeffrey Combs, an alien by the name of Tyrion, which sounds close to Tyrion, depending on how you want to say it. And, well, he's not servicing him first because this person first encounters Kira and Odo in the bar, and he starts hitting on Kira. Kira says, "Oh no, I'm here with my lover, Odo," and Odo's like, what? And later, Tyrion goes to Quark and says, "Oh, she's ravishing. She's amazing. I must have, you know, I must meet with her." And Quark agrees to try to get him a holodeck program with Kira. And hilarity ensues the rest of the episode as Quark tries different ways to try to get Kira into a holodeck suite, going so far as to claim that she is the 1,000,000th customer in his bar, which backfires when he gives her money to spend on the Dabo wheel and a bottle of champagne, and you have 1 hour in the holodeck, and she's like, "Oh, great, I can give this to Enton so-and-so for her birthday." And he's like, "Rats, foiled again." And then later he's trying to take a holo photo picture of her, which I can't believe he could be looking through a camera, see two people walking towards him, and still be stupid enough to stand there and still keep trying to take the picture. Anyway, she comes up and basically threatens him within an inches of his life or of his lobes if she catches him trying to take a photo of her again. And then later he actually breaks into the system's personnel records to download all her vital stats, her voice print, her psychological profile, and then he's going to use that to create a holodeck program of her. But her and Odo catch wind of it, and they tinker around with it. So when Quark actually gives Tyrion the program, Tyrion goes in to find a lovely Kira-like body in a bed, who then leans up her head, its head, and it's Quark's head on Kira's body. Oh boy. And he runs out and threatens to ruin Quark, and then you could cue the funny Star Trek in music. Dun, 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 dun. So that's the good. Here's the bad. So the Defiant is in the Gamma Quadrant doing a little exploration when suddenly out of nowhere, poof, a planet pops up, and they meet a group of people on there that they discover, oh, this planet goes in and out of dimensions every, right now it's about every 60 years. Oh, but the process seems to be speeding up, and eventually you'll never come back here. And I'm going to fall in love with the guy that has the Shell Oil symbol smashed on the side of his head at his eyes for no apparent reason. And I'm just headlong, and I'm going to give up my career in Starfleet and the fact that I'm a Trill and all my knowledge. I'm going to go away in this other dimension and stay with this guy. And, you know, he's going to count my spots because they go all the way down. And, they're going to beam me through or change my molecular structure so I can beam off with these people. Oh, but oh my God, when the planet decides to go into the other dimension, I guess I'm too much of an anchor. You know, literally, figuratively, metaphorically, whatever. And the planet's trying to tear itself apart before it can fade off into existence. And then it finally does fade off to existence. And nobody thought about maybe beaming her off the damn planet, because when it disappears, she's going to be in the middle of freaking space. And she almost dies, but then they get her. And then she's all depressed because she's not going to see the guy that she fell in love with for no apparent reason other than the fact that he was there and was driven by the plot. And she's sad and says she'll see him in 60 years. But hey, in another season, she's going to fall in love with Worf and forget this guy completely. Ta-da! In the story.
The end.
The end.
That was much better than the synopsis that's in the companion. So, go on then, Bill. What did you think of this episode?
I think I'm going to give my grade right now. It's a 2.5 because it would half of it was great and half of it sucked. So it's going to average out right in the middle. Because I saw no reason for why she fell in love with Dural, who I spent more time watching this trying to figure out what do those things on the side of his eyes look like. And where have I seen this actor before? I'm like, I know I've seen this actor in Lost.
Person of interest. Oh, and Lost, yeah.
It is in Lost, but I couldn't remember what.
What did he play in Lost?
He played, I just looked that up this morning. He was married to the therapist. He was on the Others. He was with the Others side. So the people that were on the island. But I don't remember. I really don't remember his role. And I was also wondering, what angle is his nose at? Because, man, he's got a honker on him. And I'm surprised he didn't cut Jadzia's spots right off her face. So that's how much I cared not for the planet plot line in this. Whereas the other side, I thought it was great. It was funny. It kept me. That was the only thing that kept me involved in this episode, was the bar plot line with Quark. The rest of it.
How do you have a bar plot line like that? Actually mention Morn's name and not have Morn in the episode.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I caught that too. Well, yeah, they even brought him up, so it was a Morn mentioning, but not a Morn sighting.
Very disappointing on that. Honestly, I think my feelings are not as strong as yours are on this episode. As far as the main plot line, my thoughts were yawn. And as far as the secondary plot line, I thought it was mildly amusing, but not worth the time it took.
I think this main plot line was a unused Next Generation story that was going to happen to some adjunct, notice the word adjunct, crewman instead of one of the main people, and that they didn't have enough of a story to use it as a full episode, or it would have been like a B plot in a Next Gen episode. I just don't feel this had. I just didn't like it. It's
yeah, it's I'm not arguing with you. I thought this plot was, I thought it was very, very cliched.
You know, I mean,
they
she
meet,
just
they
falls
fall in
head
love.
Over. But why?
There was no chemistry between the characters, as far as I could tell.
No.
So I agreed with you that there was no real thought process of, you know, okay, you know, I feel bad that these star-crossed lovers. There was none of that. I didn't care. It was like, good riddance. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Get out of here. Give Jadzia air.
yeah, because she's suffocating. Like, beam her up, you morons.
I also, from a logistical point of view, it made no sense that this planet comes back every 60 years and they're totally unaware of it. You know, you would think something of, you know, an event of that magnitude, they'd know. It's not like, okay, this happened 600 years ago.
No, but
it was 60 years ago.
But it was in the, but that planet was in the Gamma Quadrant, though. That's why they didn't know. I believe.
Oh, okay.
Well,
I'll accept that.
That was one of my other problems with the episode, though. They've already established we can't go into the Gamma Quadrant exploring much anymore because the Jem Hadar are there. And then they just tossed that away with one line of dialogue.
Yeah.
But okay, so let's just accept that logic, as poor as it is. So this planet just appeared out of nowhere. Why don't you come and join us for dinner? Is it safe? Yeah, it's safe. Oh, okay, we'll all come down.
Really?
You know what? How are you?
Why did they just leave? Why didn't they just leave the planet? Why?
Are they tied to the planet in some way?
They didn't.
Well, no, but he was going to leave.
He was going to. They didn't say that. Are these people just?
You're right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
They're just like, well, this is our home. Well, your home is going to disappear eventually. You're stupid. You know.
We'll put together a big space arc and get you out of there.
Take all your kids. Maybe we'll make one trip.
Apparently, it's a regular Earth-like. It's a Class M atmosphere.
Yeah. So. There's a billion of those out there in the galaxy.
Yeah. I mean, we'll put you on the piece of an action world.
See, I don't disagree with anything that you've just said. When you do these episodes where the main character falls in love in the space of one episode, you need two actors who can generate enough chemistry to make you believe it. And like Shatner and Joan Collins pulled it off. Paul Michael Glaser in Seasoned Hubley did it brilliantly in an episode of Starsky and Hutch. There's any number of other examples you can come up with where they did manage it. This isn't one of them.
Michael Landon and Bonnie Bedelia.
Yeah.
Or Bonanza.
Or Bonanza.
I mean, we've seen Jadzia be flirtatious before and not have these emotional, you know, she's, you know, the trainer guy of, you know what I'm talking about. She's very flirtatious and open and stuff like that. And to suddenly decide she's, you know, locked in. Like, I don't remember how long it takes for her to fall for Worf.
But, oh, it's, I think it's a good season.
Yeah, and yeah. This is just bam, like 5-10 minutes, and
oh, and it was like immediately, you know. It's so, you know, the second they see each other, oh, let's make it look like it's love at first sight. Well, you know what? It's not.
No, there's nothing between Terry Farrell and Brett Cullen. There's more between Terry Farrell and Avery Brooks when she goes to tell him that she's leaving, and she says, "You've not wished me luck." That scene really
that
sizzles
was a more
between the
emotional.
Two of them.
That was the only good thing out of that whole side of the storyline.
Yeah.
That you felt that emotion between them.
That's it. So Drek. The A plot falls flat on its face because the central relationship doesn't work. Before you even get into the science fiction gobbledygook, of which there is a shit ton in this episode.
And none of it makes any sense to me.
No. Well, I don't mind that it doesn't make sense if I cur. Normally, I can just switch off with the science fiction gobbledygook because I'm curring what's going on with the characters, but I didn't cur here. Because like Bill said, we know she's going to fall for Worf in half a season. So this guy's going to disappear and never be seen again. Yeah,
I think that's almost unfair to say, well, because I know she's going to fall for Worf,
right,
so this falls flat. If we were watching this as it was coming out, I still don't think we'd say, oh, look, this is the love of our life.
No, this guy came,
he went, and we're never going to hear from him again.
Yeah, it falls flat without knowing what's coming up in the future. It just doesn't work. So then you're left with a comedy B story that fortunately manages to carry the episode, even though I do think that the ultimate resolution was a bit too whimsical for Kira and Odo. You know, the amount of times Quark's pulled this shit now and not been kicked off the station.
Yeah, because he was accessing the private records. You know, he obviously had some type of encryption thing that they should be busting him. Oh, wait, that's right. We don't bust people for accessing classified info. Oh, wait, I'm getting into politics. I should be quiet. Never mind.
So you won't be topical by the time this comes out. Oh, no, actually, it will be, because a politician somewhere will do something stupid. That's pretty much guaranteed.
Yeah, and who knows? That particular politician may be our president.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
No matter who wins, we lose.
Yeah, we don't have anyone ruling my country, so I'm in no position to throw any stones.
Can we have the queen back, please?
Yeah, can we have the queen back?
That's right, yeah, she's let's all get back together, even though we were the original Britain exit.
You were the original Brexiteers. Tell
I
want to
come back.
Let's just
back.
All get together and make our own country up. Let's do that.
There we go.
Yeah, that aspect of that subplot does fall flat, because they wouldn't. There would have to be bigger ramifications for his actions than that. They embarrassed him. This episode is just chock full of lazy writing.
This is just like an episode in a bubble. It's not going to affect anything. It doesn't really move anything forward. At least I don't think it does. It's just there. It was just. Yeah,
I'll give you a positive. I like any time I see Jeffrey Combs in a Star Trek episode.
Yeah.
He's always playing different people, but I always enjoy him.
Well, I think the thing as well, how distinctly unmemorable this episode is, I'd forgotten he was in it. And he's
same
normally
thing.
One of the
most
memorable things about an episode he's in.
I know. I was like, is that Jeffrey Combs? I don't remember him playing this alien. Oh, okay.
If it makes you feel any better, in the Star Trek Deep Space Nine Companion, nobody involved with this episode likes it either. Every single one of them says they threw away the script 6 days before starting production and were rewriting it the day before it was filming. So that throughout the production of this one, they were writing scenes that were to be filmed tomorrow. And Ron Moore says, with doing that, they never actually were able to step back, look at the entire story and say what's working and what's not working. They were literally just writing this and throwing the pages at the actors because they were on stage. They were filming it.
Mm. And it's a shame because Jonathan Frakes is, I mean, his, usually his directing is pretty good and memorable on some of the episodes that he's done.
To be fair, it's not unmemorable on this. I love the shot of the top, from the top of the tree, of Jadzia and Guy from Person of Interest. That's a lovely angle.
Yeah.
And it does get some lovely location photography, which Deep Space Nine very rarely does. They're normally stuck on the station. So I honestly don't think we can lay this at the steps of Jonathan Frakes. I honestly think, as Ron Moore says, the writing's just not there on this one.
Well, I'm going to read to you from, the Memory Alpha? On the background information, it says, Meridian is based on Brigadoon, a musical about a magical Scottish village that appears only once every 100 years. Co-executive producer Ira Stephen Baer, an admirer of Brigadoon, confessed to originating the idea about making an episode based on the musical. Of his idea to do a Star Trek show based on Brigadoon, Baer says, I am a moron. Then it goes on, it says, Mark Garrod O'Connell commented, Meridian is an outer space version of Brigadoon with Dax as Gene Kelly. It's really a fun story. We know that Dax has had many romantic entanglements over the course of 300 years, but this is the first time that Jadzia Dax has fallen in love. That's the angle on which I'm building this script. There isn't a whole lot of jeopardy or danger, and there are no bad guys. In that sense, it's a lot like Second Sight. It's a story, it's a light story in many ways, but it has emotional weight for Dax, and it's very appealing. All of her friends have to realize that this is her first romance. Sisko is used to thinking of Dax as old Curzon, and it comes as a shock to him. Bleh. I guess he wrote it and he was too tied into his own writing to realize what a piece of shit he wrote, but at least Stephen Baer realized that this was a mistake based on his quote.
Yeah, going off the companion, I don't know how much of his original script was left. You know, if they're saying that they were rewriting this as they were shooting it, I'm presuming that's not the writer doing that. I'm presuming that's the staff. So maybe his original script was great. No idea.
I doubt it. I just...
The world may never know. But you know what I'm wondering? What would Blaine say?
Ooh, that's a good question. What do you think Blaine would say? Blaine would say, Hi guys, I'm Meridian. This is, in my opinion, one of the weakest episodes of the series. It felt like Brigadoon done wrong. So I'm somewhat happy to read that Ira Stephen Baer's goal was to do Brigadoon on Star Trek, and that he's the first to admit it didn't work. The good news is that it brings us a role for Jeffrey Combs. But that subplot ended with Quark still on the station, which I don't believe for a second, given what we know of Kira to date. She already has problems with Quark, and this would have been an I go or he goes, and I'm not going anywhere situation for her, as far as I'm concerned. In short, if you missed it, just track down Gene Kelly, Sid Charisse, and Van Johnson in the Vincent Minnelli film adaptation of Brigadoon instead. Much more satisfying.
Now, I have to say, I did not read his email.
Neither did I. I okay. Tried not to because I don't want it to influence what we say.
Every major point that we said, he also says.
I'm always concerned that if he hits on something that contradicts what we think, it may influence how we're looking at it, and I would rather we give our own opinions and then factor his into what we're saying. So I generally don't read his emails in advance, and I had not read this one, but we basically hit on all the same points.
Only
Blaine, as he is wont to do, did so in a very terse and intelligent manner, which took us 25 minutes to do.
Yeah, to say exactly the same thing. Fair enough.
I guess we could rate this one now.
Yeah, OK. Okay. Well, Bill already has.
2.5.
Yeah, well.
And I think that's kind of high, but I'm just going to stick with it.
Yeah, I'll come right up front. I'm going to give it a 2.0. I think this is one of the weakest episodes so far in the series. Not only is it weak, it doesn't have any of the kitschiness. I mean, for all its crap, at least we laugh a lot at Move Along Home. This has nothing. This is totally unmemorable. By the time we record next time, this will probably have been purged from our minds, and we probably won't think about it again, because there's nothing about this that makes any difference going forward. Not only does it not make any difference, it wasn't particularly enjoyable to watch. I thought it was effectively boring. The subplot comes off kind of as almost a sitcom episode, and while that can be enjoyable, I don't think it lifted this episode to any extent other than to just give you something that made you chuckle slightly. But it didn't really make sense in the context of the show anyway. So 2.0, and I think I'm being generous.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement on this one. I'm going to go 2 as well, simply because it isn't bad enough for a 1. You know, the acting's there, some of the scenes work well, the B-plot's fun. And, you know, Jeffrey Combs, so 2.
Yeah, I mean, I like I said, I think 2 is being generous.
Yeah, it is, but it's not bad enough to give it a 1.
I was just reading some trivia about this. This is Jeffrey Combs' first appearance in Star Trek, believe it or not. And also, I did not know this, Combs, who had originally auditioned for the role of William T. Riker on Star Trek The Next Generation, was cast as Tyrion by this episode's director, Jonathan Frakes. So how different would The Next Gen be if Jeffrey Combs had been number one?
Jeffrey Combs is a much...
Yeah, very different.
He's a very different actor from Riker.
Frakes.
William Frakes. In that... While Jeffrey Combs has his own charismatic way about him, it's almost kind of less a sly charisma.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas William Frakes is more what you see is what you get. I don't think there's the...
He's more bombat, like he's just like a man's man.
I'm
not saying
exactly.
Jeffrey Combs isn't a man. I don't mean that. It's just he's a different... His mannerisms, it would have been completely different. I mean, just the fact that just now when we were discussing Riker and you said William Frakes, that we mix Riker and Jonathan Frakes are one, just like Kirk.
That's William Frakes, you're right.
Just like Kirk and William Shatner in our heads are the same person.
But I think we have some contrast on TNG between Picard and Riker. Mm-hmm. In that Picard is the more subtle, softer, more sly character, and Riker is more bombastic, as you said. I think that Combs would have played Riker too much closer to the way that we were getting Picard already.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it would have been... I don't think there would have been the chemistry, and I don't think the character would have been differentiated enough. And I think we almost might have fallen into a situation like in Voyager, where Chakotay made such a weak first officer that other people on the show were more interesting than him, and you had to move on. I don't think, not to denigrate Jeffrey Combs and his performance, because I think he's terrific, but I don't think he fit that role. And I think they did well not casting him in it.
The right people got the job.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
I was just
want to read some email?
Sure.
Yeah, go on.
I'm looking for goofs or other things. Any other? Okay. I guess you.
Well, in the meanwhile, I'm going to read an email from Mr. Tim Elliott called "Episode 34" or "What's in the Box."
What's in the box?
Greetings, gentlemen. I'm catching up on past episodes, so I apologize if this email is long past the episode airing. I wanted to share a few of my thoughts on your coverage of the episode Paradise. I'm not sure I agree with you that this is a forgettable episode. Now, which episode was this?
Very good.
Almost Paradise.
It does have some strong performance by Avery Brooks and Gail Strickland, and I feel the story is well written, even if it doesn't. As Andy says, if it doesn't quite work. I rematched the shows along with the podcast, and this one I remembered much of the story. I feel much of the success of the episode has to be placed at Brooks's feet. I love the way he plays the quiet, simmering anger, and frustration that is just below the surface. Brooks always played Sisko as having such strong will and unmovable determination. Put Shatner or Stewart in the episode, and the tone is very different. Gail Strickland is a good foil for Sisko, and she, like all great villains, doesn't see herself as a villain. I felt the episode was better than just average, but my only real complaint is the idea of shunning technology. Whenever a sci-fi story has an individual group reject technology, they revert to a more agrarian style of living. Living off the land, no phone, no light, no motor car, not a single luxury like Robinson. Oh, I'm sorry. I understand it's written in such a way to give contemporary audiences a frame of reference, but could you say Picard's brother is shunning technology by refusing to own a replicator? Technology is relevant. Clothing is technology. A shovel is technology. Shelter is technology. I look forward to the next show. Cheers, Tim Elliott, Texas. P.S. This episode reminds me of a fourth season Twilight episode, On Thursday We Leave for Home, in which a group of survivors from a crashed spacecraft are governed by a charismatic leader. I'm trying to remember that episode off the top of my head. I'm having a tough time with it. But, you know, I always respect Tim's opinion and the fact that he liked the episode. More power to him. But I stand by my opinion. I thought this was a, you know, none too great episode. And I don't know. What did we rate this one, if anybody recalls? I gave it a 3. Andy, you gave it a 2.5, and Sean gave it a 3. So, I mean, I don't think we totally crushed it.
No, but middle of the road.
But I do, yeah, I think middle of the road is probably a fair description of it. I don't think it really did much, and I think, if my memory is right, I think we did agree, though, that Avery Brooks was pretty good in it. So.
All right, do you want me to do next one?
Oh, sorry, I was looking up On Thursday We Leave for Home.
Do you want me to do the next one, then?
Yes, since I synopsized, I'm taking the Andy role of this episode. I don't do email.
You're not as good a diva as I am, darling.
Yes.
Our next email is not so simple, Garrick. It's by Gene Hendricks. Thank you, Gene. Andy and Paul. And Bill. I'll add Bill on the end. I know it goes without saying, but Andy Robinson was brilliant in this episode. I love how even when he thinks he's dying, Garrick is still fabricating things. One issue I had with the episode was Bashir. Not the acting, that was actually really good. No, the problem I have is that the chief medical officer is only worried about one patient, to the point of staying in Garrick's quarters. Surely they would have set something up in the medical bay for him. Good thing there wasn't another medical emergency. Still, that was my only issue with this episode, which is pretty damn good. Gene. P.S. Sean was right. If you guys sing, I'm not writing in. I listen, because I'm fucking nuts, but I won't write in. Well, that's not writing to this one, Gene, because Paul just sang.
Yes, we won't be hearing from Gene.
Which would be a shame, because I like Gene's emails, especially that one, which I got to read under my diva I didn't do the synopsis contract, and it was very short.
I got to admit, Gene's emails are superior to my rendition of the Gilligan's Island theme.
A tale of a fateful ship.
Oh, I'm so tempted just to burst into song again, and I'm resisting, Gene.
Are you fighting it?
You're welcome.
Yes.
Well, resistance is futile.
There's other medical personnel on the station. He's not the only.
No, he isn't, but he's the chief medical officer. Gene's right. That should have been delegated.
But Garrick's his friend.
Reason for him to renege himself from that particular incident. He's too close to it.
Well, maybe he was protecting Garrick's privacy and not having him being, you know, everyone seeing his... Because that's the one where he's having the withdrawal, right? I believe when he had so that's, you know, they didn't want to have everybody expose Garrick to everyone else and have him, you know, showing him breaking down, etc.
babbity blabbity blabbity. I'm babbling.
All right, what do you think? What, time for one more?
Yeah, go on.
All right, the next one is also from Tim Elliott. Greetings, gentlemen, and Andy.
Sorry.
F you, dude.
Another fine show from the Prophet's crew. I have a few questions, observations on the episode Shadow Play, and they stem from my problems in the way the holographic technology is portrayed in the past TOS series. Before I go into my questions, I would like to say I did enjoy the episode for the most part. If I were to grade it based on your scale, I would give it a 2. I would give it 2.5 bars of platinum. And let's take a quick look and see what we gave it before we go any further. We all gave it a 2.5, so yeah, we're in accordance with Tim and his email. He gave three questions here, so I'm going to read each one and then stop so that we can have a little discussion of them. One. Don't you think Coleus and the others accepted their existence as holograms pretty quickly? I understand you only have 45 minutes to tell the story, but would there be more doubt, or at least Rorigan would program them not to accept themselves as holograms? That's a pretty good question, and it probably would take more than 45 minutes to do it, and I think that's the only reason they would really have. I would think either he would program some sort of denial thing into them, that they just would never, like, they wouldn't accept it, or they wouldn't understand it, or something along those lines, or they would have to have a point where their hologram nature would have to be proven to them.
No,
that would require an extra scene, which they probably didn't have time to do.
So, I remember that one. If the holograms think they're real people, and you used some whatever basis of a program, say, and they had children too, in that episode. Do holographic people have holographic body functions? Like, do they have holographic poo?
Do holograms dream of electric sheep is what you're asking.
Right. I mean, like, how far does that program go in that, you know, we got to get rid of this holographic waste? Or, you know, it's like how much are they...
Where'd all the poo go?
Yeah, it's like, it drops and then just disappears after it's... You know, I'm not trying to be trite or... I'm honestly asking, like, how far does that programming go with those holograms to think they're human? Or do they just edit that out that, you know, well, we never go to the, you know, we eat, but we never go to the bathroom? Or do they even eat? I'm getting too deep. My head hurts.
Okay, well, I think I'm going to go on to the next question because I think it kind of touches on that
same
thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
Where does Rorigan sleep? What does he eat? Does his projector work like the holodeck and create a mixture of true holograms and transporter-based actual objects? Does it create food for him? So, yeah, that's a logistic that I think just makes your head hurt.
But Rorigan,
if
the holograms
are not
guy.
Eating real food, but Rorigan is a real person, so he needs real food, you know... Are you creating real food that these holograms aren't really eating but are somehow destroying and using up the natural resources of this planet that they're on? Or are they eating holographic food that's just kind of pretend like they are? And if they're doing that, what's Rorigan eating? So, like I said, I think it just makes my head hurt.
Soylent Green's made of holograms! It's made of holograms!
3. What happens when Rorigan dies? Will the others bury him, if that is their tradition? Can they bury him? Are they solid or just projections of photons? Well, I think in the holodeck, they do use force field technology to make them solid. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think they can bury him if they are programmed to do such. I don't know if upon his death, if the program just kind of runs out and it's over. I would think now that they have this sentience that they know they're holograms, they could perhaps be taught to maintain the holographic projection, and if he dies, you know, they can keep their own existence going. But I think we had a lengthy discussion about the logistics of sentient hologram programs and how that is a wormhole just not to go down. So anyway. The holodeck suites in the post-TOS universe have always confused me a bit. They seem to be able to do whatever the story needs from them. Well, those are my thoughts on Shadowplay. I thought the B-plot with Quark and Kira was fun, but not necessarily memorable. Which I agree with, because I don't remember it. I did enjoy seeing Kenneth Toby, as I am a big fan of so many of his B-movies in the 1950s. Many, I'm sure, will be covered on Jason Giaconetti's Bots, Bugs, and Babes podcast. Cheers, Tim Elliott, Third Degree Burn podcast. Shameless plug.
There's no such thing as a shameless plug.
Oh, there absolutely is, and we welcome them.
All plugs welcome.
Thanks for the thoughts, Tim, and I agree with everything pretty much that you're saying for the most part. And, you know, it's just those are the weaknesses to this episode. And I don't think there's a lot that we can do about that, unfortunately. But I do agree that once you start thinking about it, it really kind of falls apart on you.
Okay, so on Thursday, Twilight Zone episode on Thursday, we leave for home. It was the one where James Whitmore was the captain of a outpost, of an Earth outpost. And everybody basically there is like, look, this has failed. We need to leave.
We are failing.
And so there's a ship that's coming to pick them up. And basically he's like, no, we're not leaving. We're not going to, you know, we're going to make this work, blah, blah, blah. And basically ship comes, they all decide to leave, but James Whitmore, he stays, and he's kind of a little gone loopy, and he still thinks all the people are there, and then they've actually already all flown away in the ship, and then he realizes that they are all gone, and then he's like, but wait, come back for me, blah, 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 you know, and do-do-do-do-do-do, there you go.
I want to stay.
I don't want to stay.
I vaguely remember that one. I know I've seen it because I've seen all of them, but I don't have a strong enough memory to compare it.
I only remembered it by reading this little quick synopsis, and that was it.
I remember James Whitmore being in an episode like that, but I really don't remember any of the fine details of it. So, like I said, I can't really give an analysis or a comparison.
He was in a couple. So I don't think he was in as many as Burgess Meredith was.
Because there was time.
There's time now. We need time. Because there's holograms now.
All right, have we exhausted Meridian?
I think we've pretty much shot Meridian full of holes and ready to move on to an episode that hopefully we'll like. Which episode will that be?
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, Jonathan Frakes steps in front of the camera for Defiant, written by Ron Moore. So that promises to be good.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. But anyway, we'll see you next time, everybody. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast, is a Two True Freaks presentation. It is hosted by Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro. The music and sound clips used in the show are copyright CBS and Paramount Entertainment. If you like to buy stuff from Amazon, and who doesn't, why not drop by the twotruefreaks.com website, where if you click the little link that we have there, it will take you straight through that site, and whilst it won't cost you any extra, we'll put a few shekels in our tip jar, which helps create content like this. We very much hope you enjoyed listening to The Prophets. Every episode is dedicated to the memory of our pal, Sean Engel.
All right, go ahead, Paul. I got you past that first sentence.
I'm going to edit all of this out, so I'm going to start it from the beginning again.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I don't want to sound like these. You.
Andy edits these, and I think Andy will leave that in there.
Yeah, Andy doesn't edit these.
What?
I do Firefly.
What? Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shoot me at home.
Blam. Shoot me now.
Okay.